Mother's War by David Irving. Triumph of the Will. Before July 1934 was over, there was a further damage to Hitler's image abroad. In an impatient attempt at overthrowing the dictatorial regime in Vienna, panicky Austrian SS gunmen shot dead the Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss in his Viennese office on July 25th. Mussolini was deeply shocked at the murder and this set back German-Italian relations. In later years, Hitler protested his complete ignorance of the plot. The Goebbels' diaries preserved on microfiches in Moscow and the private papers of the military commander of Bavaria's Military District 7 give the lie to this, however. After returning from Venice in June, Hitler had confided to Dr. Goebbels his belief that Mussolini had agreed to give him carte blanche in Austria. "Out with Dollfuss," Goebbels had summarized. Quote, "New elections under a neutral man of confidence. Influence of Nazis depending on number of votes. Economic issues to be resolved jointly by Rome and Berlin. Both are agreed. Dollfuss will be notified," unquote. The two dictators had also discussed other matters. On disarmament, Mussolini fully endorsed Hitler's position. Quote, "France has gone mad," unquote, he had said. They had also discussed, quote, "the East," unquote. They would try to build on a closer friendship with Poland, quote, and seek a modus vivendi with Russia, unquote. Hitler mentioned the coming coup in Vienna to Goebbels over lunch on July 10th, and the minister found him conferring secretly with the Austrian Nazi leader, Theo Habicht, at the annual Richard Wagner Festival in Bayreuth on July 22nd. Goebbels was skeptical as to whether it would come off, but Hitler that morning ordered General Wilhelm Adam to report to him in Bayreuth. To the perplexed general, Hitler revealed, quote, "Today the Austrian army is going to overthrow the government," end quote. He revealed that Dr. Anton Rintelen, a prominent Austrian politician, was going to take Dollfuss's place, and that Rintelen would authorize the return of all Austrian refugees, i.e. the Austrian Nazis who had fled to Germany. Adam's job would be to equip these Austrian quote-unquote legionnaires with weapons from German army stocks. Hitler assured him, quote, "The moment I get word from Vienna, I'll inform you. Then you will believe me," unquote. Soon the first reports came in, and they were not good. Quote, "Big rumpus," noted Goebbels. "Colossal tension. Awful weight. I'm still skeptical," end quote. At 3 p.m., Hitler telephoned, quote, "Everything is going to according to plan in Vienna. The government building is in our hands. Dollfuss has been injured. The rest of the news is confused as yet. I'll phone again," end quote. He never did, however, because Dollfuss was dead and Europe's capitals were in an uproar. The Habicht plot had failed for three reasons. First, he had exaggerated the size of his following in Austria, particularly the support from the Austrian army. Second, the plot had been leaked to Dollfuss's cabinet, and some ministers had betaken themselves to safety. And third, the illegal Austrian SA movement, disgruntled by the events of June 30th in Germany, willfully withheld the support they had promised. The SS gang involved made matters worse. Worse for Hitler by appealing in a panic to the German legation for assistance. Hitler disowned them. He closed the frontier, sent a telegram of sympathy to Dollfuss's widow, and at Goebbels' suggestion, he dismissed Habicht. The assassins were publicly hanged in Vienna. 2 days after Dollfuss's murder, Hitler spoke frankly to Goebbels about the future. Quote, "He was a prophetic vision," noted the minister. "Germany as master of the world, job for a century," end quote. Hitler sent Franz von Papen, his vice-chancellor, to Vienna as, quote, "special ambassador," unquote, and rushed Dr. Hans Lammers up to Neudeck in East Prussia to notify President Hindenburg. Lammers returned with word that the aged president was dying. On August 1st, Hitler himself flew to Neudeck to take leave of the field marshal. It was difficult for the dying and delirious old man to speak, and he kept addressing Hitler as, quote-unquote, "Your Majesty." That evening, Hitler told his cabinet that the doctors gave Hindenburg less than 24 hours to live. The cabinet enacted the following law, quote, "The office of Reich President is combined with that of Reich Chancellor. In consequence, the previous powers of the Reich President will devolve on the Führer." Yeah. On the Führer and Reich Chancellor, Adolf Hitler. He will nominate his own deputy.
Hindenburg died the next day, his last words being to convey his best wishes to Herr Hitler. In a plebiscite on August 19th, 90% of the German people voted in favor of the new law. Quote, "Thus," Hitler said triumphantly to Blomberg, "I have conquered Germany." End quote. The oath of allegiance of the Wehrmacht was now transferred to the Führer. Only Blomberg as war minister could actually issue orders, however, a formal obstacle which would not be removed until 1938. Meantime, Hitler's own SS regiments began to appear, the spectacular parades of his tall and muscular troops being the highlight of the party rally in 1934. The SS uniform was black and elegant. There was no shortage of candidates for this immaculate elite that Himmler had created. The SS had an enforced mysticism, which even Hitler found slightly ludicrous. In 1940, witnessing the pagan Yule celebration of the SS Liebenstarte at Christmas, he quietly mocked to an adjutant that this would never take the place of quote-unquote Silent Night. He announced to Blomberg that he would allow the SS to raise only one armed division, the Verfügungstruppe, the forerunner of the Waffen-SS. To Hitler, the Waffen-SS was a fourth armed service, an elite. As late as 1942, he ruled that the peacetime ratio of Waffen-SS to regular army should be pegged at 1 to 10. The army, however, envied and mistrusted the SS. Now that the SA had been emasculated, General von Fritsch suspected that Himmler was intriguing against him. Generals claimed that the SS was assembling dossiers on them. Hidden microphones were actually discovered in the military district HQ in Munich. In 1938, when the safe in Blomberg's office would not shut properly, it was found to be jammed by a wire, which was traced to an amplifier beneath the floorboards. The Abwehr traced the wiring to the Gestapo HQ. The second half of 1934 was marked by this open hostility between the party and the Wehrmacht. The party suspected that Fritsch was plotting an army coup against Hitler. Colonel Karl Bodenschatz heard his boss Goering discuss this with Hitler. Milch also confirmed these rumors. Hitler may have anticipated an assassination attempt. Believing himself to be dying in December 1934, he bent his mind to Germany's future without him, and on the 13th he persuaded the cabinet to pass a law allowing him to name his own successor. A noisy campaign began, fed by foreign newspapers and emigre organizations abroad with the talk of an impending bloodbath. Hitler's nerves were so frayed that the summoned party and Wehrmacht leaders to the Prussian State Opera House at short notice. He summoned party and Wehrmacht leaders to the Prussian State Opera House at short notice on January 3rd, 1935, and in a dramatic two-hour speech again stated his unswerving loyalty to the Wehrmacht, which he described as a pillar of state, as vital for Germany's future as the Nazi Party itself. Quote, "both of equal importance and invincible as long as they remain united," unquote. Werner Best later recalled that this speech was a mixture of threats and exhortations. Quote, "its climax was his despairing pronouncement that he would put a bullet through his brains if the various Reich agencies refused to work in harmony." End quote. Admiral Hermann Boehm recalled Hitler as saying, quote, "suppose some party official comes up to me and says, quote, well, that's all and good, mein Führer, but General so-and-so is talking and working against you," unquote. "Then I reply, I won't believe it. And if he then says, here is the written proof, mein Führer, I tear the rubbish up, because my faith in the Wehrmacht is unshakable," end quote. Goebbels and Goering drafted a declaration of loyalty for the letter to read out to the Führer. Quote, "after the Führer's speech," Fritsch recorded himself, "the witch hunt by the SS has died down for a time." Hitler attended to the Wehrmacht body and soul. He documented a genuine interest in military technology. His unusually receptive brain soaking up the data and dimensions shown to him so well that he could regurgitate them years later without an error. On February 6, 1935, he toured the Army's research station at Kummersdorf, the first chancellor to do so since 1890. Blomberg and Reichenau actively supported the modern tank and armored car prototypes displayed there by Guderian, but neither Fritsch nor his chief of staff, Ludwig Beck, looked favorably on this modern war technology. Beck was a calm, dedicated staff officer appointed on October 1933 for his right-wing views. He had connived in the events of June 30th, 1934. He profoundly mistrusted radio, however, and all other newfangled gadgets. After this display, Hitler decided he could flex the new Wehrmacht muscles. On March 9, 1935, a Saturday, he formally announced that Germany had created a secret air force. A week later, he reintroduced conscription in violation of Versailles. Goebbels recorded how that decision was reached. Quote, "Discussions all Saturday morning, March 16th. Führer argues with Blomberg over the number of divisions. Gets his own way. 36. Grand proclamation to the people. Law on rebuilding the armed forces. Conscription. To put an end to the haggling, you've got to create fait accompli. The others aren't going to side, or the other side aren't going to war over it. As for their curses, stuff cotton wool in our ears. Cabinet, 1:30 p.m. Führer sets out situation. Very grim. Then reads out the proclamation and law. Powerful emotion seize us all. Blomberg rises to his feet and thanks to the Führer. Heil Hitler for the first time in these rooms. With one law, Versailles is expunged. Historic hour. Tremor of eternity. Gratitude that we are able to witness and take part in this." End quote. Mussolini protested uneasily and joined with France to repeat at mid-April 1935 meeting at Stresa that any German violation of a demilitarized zone along the Rhine would call forth Italian interventions as well as British and French, under the terms of the Locarno Treaty. General von Fritsch informed the army generals that any German violation of the Rhineland status that year would certainly be, quote, "the drop that overflows the barrel," end quote. That same month, however, Hitler learned that France was preparing an alliance with the Soviet Union, and that it was to be extended to include Czechoslovakia. 25 big airfields were already under construction, far in excess of any legitimate Czech needs. On April 24th, Fritsch assured his generals, quote, "The Führer is determined to avoid war and will leave no stone unturned to that end. Whether he succeeds in this depends on us alone," end quote. On May 2nd, Blomberg, therefore, circulated a secret provisional directive for operation training, Schulung, a possible surprise attack on Czechoslovakia designed to eliminate that risk in the event of war in the West. On July 10th, Blomberg issued a further important directive. It provided that any French invasion of the Rhineland would be used as casus belli, or casus belli, by Hitler. He would stage a holding action there until the Rhine bridges could be blown. The Wehrmacht would then defend Germany on the Rhine. In the meantime, Hitler had resumed his overtures to Britain, again choosing Joachim von Ribbentrop as his negotiator. As he elucidated to his appreciative generals speaking in Munich on March 17th, quote, "My foreign ministry doesn't influence foreign policy. It just registers political occurrences," end quote. His own view was, quote, "The British will come running to us sooner or later," end quote. Later that month, Sir John Simon, the British Foreign Secretary, and Anthony Eden appeared in Berlin to try to secure some limitations on German rearmament. Hitler received them in the Congress Room of the Chancellery and bragged that his army was expanding to 36 divisions, which was true, and that his Luftwaffe was already as big as the RAF, which was not. Ribbentrop delivered this advice to Hitler on April 3rd, quote, "I definitely do not believe in a serious development this summer," unquote. If Germany reached the spring of 1936 without trouble, then the danger of a crisis was past. Simon's visit had gone well, he said. He had returned to London convinced of the Führer's desire for peace. In fact, Sir John had talked of a new German colonial empire, drawing his hand across the map of Africa from the French Congo to Italian Somaliland. But Hitler had interrupted him. Quote, "I am not interested in colonies at present," unquote. He had proposed that the British government agree to an expansion of the German navy to a mere 35% of the British tonnage. It was Ribbentrop's undoubted achievement that Britain eventually agreed. The Anglo-German naval agreement that was now signed inspired Hitler to believe that a far-reaching alliance would be possible with Britain later on. In May 1935, he had another, more personal preoccupation, a polyp that had begun to obstruct his vocal cords. He had always had a morbid terror of cancer, having seen his mother die of it, and he secretly feared that this polyp might prove to be a cancerous growth, doomed to cut short his global career before it had really begun. On May 5th, the polyp was removed by Berlin's leading throat surgeon, Professor Karl von Eichen. Hitler was forbidden to speak for 3 days. He had to write down his instructions, even to Goering, who was bound for conference with Mussolini in Rome. On May 25th, as news reached him that the Anglo-German naval agreement was about to be signed, he was in Hamburg. Here, too, he was given the results of the pathological tests on the polyp. It was a non-malignant growth. Quote, "Today," he rejoiced to Admiral Rader, "is the happiest day of my life. This morning I was informed by my doctor that my throat infection is not serious, and this afternoon I received this tremendous political news," end quote, meaning the naval agreement. At their last meeting in August 1934, the dying Field Marshal Hindenburg had whispered, quote, "Now, Herr Hitler, don't trust the Italians," end quote. Hitler had reported this warning to his cabinet and added, according to Schwerin von Krosigk, that if ever he had to choose between Britain and Italy, Hindenburg's words would form the basis of his choice. His personal adjutant, Fritz Wiedemann, also quoted him as having said, quote, "If I have to choose between Britain and Mussolini, the choice is clear. Italy is obviously closer ideologically, but politically I see a future only in alliance with the British," end quote. Not surprisingly, Hitler considered Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia on October 3, 1935, inopportune. Quote, "The time for struggle between the static and dynamic nations is still some way off," unquote, he declared. Britain and France announced sanctions against Italy. Hitler had to choose, and he chose Italy after all. He cannot afford to see fascist Italy destroyed. To his leading generals and ministers, as Keitel recalled, Hitler explained, quote, "The day may come," he said, "when Germany too has to stand up against outside intervention, the day when we also begin to stake our rightful claims," end quote. Wiedemann recalls, quote, "When Hitler was preoccupied with some plans or other, he often shut himself up alone in his room. You could hear him pacing relentlessly up and down. The really big decisions like rearmament, occupation of the Rhineland, etc., he always took alone, mostly against the counsels of his staff and advisors. He knew full well that he alone had to bear the responsibility," end quote. Powerfully influenced by Dr. Goebbels, Hitler now abandoned the path of statesmanlike and responsible policies and embarked upon the slippery ascent toward European hegemony. By mid-January 1936, he had resolved to bolster up his none-too-robust regime by a fresh coup. He would remilitarize Germany's Rhineland, again in the violation of Versailles. As a pretext, he would take France's imminent ratification of her pact with Russia. Hitler would argue that the pact would be irreconcilable with Locarno. He revealed his intention to Dr. Goebbels on January 20th. On February 27th, over lunch with Goering and Dr. Goebbels, he still felt it premature to march into the Rhineland. The next day, however, France confirmed her treaty with the Russians. Goebbels remarkably urged caution, but Hitler made up his mind. On March 2nd, Blomberg issued a preliminary directive. The next day, Fritsch sent instructions for 3 infantry battalions to cross the Rhine to Aachen, Trier, and Saarbrücken on a given date. But Fritsch, referring to the July 10, 1935 directive, made clear that should the French counterattack, the German forces might have to withdraw to the Rhine. On March 4th, the French ratified the Russian pact. On the 5th, Blomberg ordered the occupation of the Rhineland to begin 2 days later. The cabinet approved. The infantry marched in. Hitler's step was greeted by a chorus of protest from the West and by noisy saber-rattling from the French. Blomberg lost his nerve and begged Hitler to withdraw before shooting broke out. The 3 German attachés in London sent a joint telegram of warning to Blomberg. Hitler's nerves stood the test better, however, and neither Britain nor France moved a muscle against him. He attributed this in part to the intervention of Britain's new monarch, Edward VIII. Quote, "If we keep our nerve now," felt Goebbels, reviewing the 2-week crisis in his diary, "we've won," end quote. The German public was demonstrably impressed by Hitler's methods. At the end of March 1936, he received another overwhelming vote of popular support. This time, the vote was over 90 to 1 in his favor. Contemplating Germany's economic position in 1936, Hitler chafed that so little had been accomplished to make the country self-sufficient, a basic prerequisite for war. In April, he put Hermann Göring in charge of raw materials and foreign currency questions. Aboard his yacht, Grilla at Kiel, he told Goebbels in May of his vision of the United States of Europe under German leadership. Quote, "Years, perhaps even decades of work toward that end," commented the minister in his diary. "But what an end," end quote. Quote, "The Führer," wrote Goebbels after a secret conference with Hitler, Papen, and Ribbentrop in June, "sees a conflict coming in the Far East. Japan will thrash Russia, and then our great hour will come. Then we shall have to carve off a territory, enough territory to last us 100 years. Let's hope that we're ready and that the Führer is still alive," end quote. Impatient at industry's slow progress in August, Hitler dictated to his secretary a rambling memorandum on the economy. Quote, "Four precious years have passed," he complained. "Without a doubt, we could, by today, already have been wholly independent of fuel, rubber, and even, in part, iron ore imports from abroad." End quote. Germany, he ordered, must be, quote, "capable of waging a worthwhile war against the Soviet Union, because a victory over Germany by Bolshevism would lead not to a new Versailles Treaty, but to the final annihilation, indeed the extermination of the German nation," unquote. Hitler announced that he had to resolve once and for all Germany's economic problems by enlarging her Lebensraum and thus her sources of raw materials and food. In detail, Hitler stated these two demands. Quote, "First, in 4 years the German army must be ready for action, and second, in 4 years the German economy must be ready for war," end quote. Hermann Göring himself, summoned to the Obersalzberg, was appointed head of this new, quote-unquote, four-year plan. Wiedemann would recall Göring remarking to Hitler, quote, "Mein Führer, if I am not mistaken in my views, a major war is inevitable within the next 5 years," unquote. He read Hitler's memorandum to the other cabinet members on September 4th, making one thing clear, quote, "It is based on the assumption that war with Russia is inevitable. What the Russians have accomplished, so can we," unquote. Göring's State Secretary Paul Kerner wrote on September 7th to a colleague, quote, "Göring came back from the Obersalzberg bringing us the new guidelines for our work over the next years. Unfortunately, I can't tell you more, but when you get back to Berlin, you'll find a clear path mapped out ahead," unquote. By the autumn of 1936, Hitler was already deeply involved in the Spanish Civil War. On July 25th, in the interval of an opera at Beirut, emissaries from an obscure Spanish general, Francisco Franco, had been introduced to him by Canaris. They brought an appeal from Franco for aid in overthrowing the Republican government in Madrid. Franco wanted German transport planes to ferry Moroccan troops from Tetuan in North Africa to the Spanish mainland. By October, a full-scale civil war was raging. Britain and France were committed with volunteers on the Republican side, and the first Russian tanks and bombs were detected. After discussing it with Göring, Milch, and Albert Kesselring, the Luftwaffe's new chief of staff, Hitler authorized full-scale Luftwaffe intervention. Göring sent a bomber squadron under the command of Colonel Wolfram von Richthofen to Spain on November 6th. Hitler welcomed this war for various reasons. He could test the new German equipment under combat conditions and train successive waves of officers and men. Göring also welcomed it as a means of obtaining from Spain raw materials like tungsten, copper, and tannin for the four-year plan. A day or two after Hitler delivered a, quote, "major political speech," unquote, to his cabinet on December 1st, of which no note survives, Göring commented to his department heads that the Luftwaffe was to be ready, quote, "for instant action, regardless of the cost," end quote. Germany wanted peace until 1941, Göring told them. Quote, "We can never be sure, however, that there won't be complications before then. We are, in a sense, already at war, even if not yet a shooting war," end quote. And that's the chapter.